as is traditional at events like this, I'm going to speak about federalism in the broad sense, which is to say, I'm not going to speak about it at all. Instead, I'm going to speak about two things that I know a little bit more about, my two homes, Harvard and Canada, in both of which the situation is gloomy, but illuminated by rays of light. I don't know if any of you here are from Massachusetts, but it's a very peculiar state. We recently had an important election this November, which, as far as Massachusetts was concerned, the important issues were handled quite nicely. John Kerry was elected to the U.S. Senate, and Walter Mondale carried Minnesota, and that's about as much about the election as we heard. In fact, my introduction to what kind of place it was I'd been plunked in came quite abruptly. About the first week of school, all the organizations at the Harvard Law School are allowed to propagandize for new members in the Harvard Organizational Fair. And you enter, all the first-year students enter this enormous room at which every single institution, the entire law school, is represented. And I did my little tour, and as I was coming to the very end, I noticed a brick pillar on which somebody had taped with masking tape a portrait of President Reagan and of Vice President Bush. And beside there was a young man. I said to him, "What's this?" And he said, "It's the Harvard Republican Club." And I said, "Well, why is it that you don't have a big table with lots of people behind it like every other organization here?" And he said, "Well, the Dean of Students said that political organizations would not be given a table." So I looked over my shoulder at the table. It was about twice this long with 50 people behind it, an enormous Mondale Ferraro banner behind it. And I said, "Well, what about them?" And he said, "Well, in fact, we found out about that this morning." And I went to the Dean of Students and said, "What about them?" And she said, "All right, all right, all right. I made a mistake. You can have a table, but we're out of tables." Hence the portraits. Harvard right now, at the study of law, and this I think is relevant to federalism, is dominated there by a group of people who are becoming steadily more powerful. It's a legal movement called Critical Legal Studies. And it's difficult for me to take it seriously, I'm afraid, which perhaps is a mistake. The leading guru of critical legal studies, Duncan Kennedy, said that it is a profoundly revolutionary gesture to refuse to laugh at the senior partner's jokes. He also said that his revolution believed that it was just as important to resist at the bourgeois dinner table as at the barricades. A writer about this movement said, "The nice thing about this, of course, is it allows you to go to a lot of bourgeois dinner parties and no barricades and feel very revolutionary indeed." But they do have a serious purpose, which is to show that law means nothing. The traditional rule of law, in any sense, is an obsolete idea. The judges, because there are no rules, can be permitted to do whatever they like. And incidentally, because judges don't have to be elected, at least at the federal level, they are the last best hope for the imposition of more socialist values on the United States. And finally, of course, that the very idea of law, is obsolete and should be dispensed with in favor of something called a standard, of civil obligation, which you wouldn't know about beforehand, which no one would vote upon, but which would simply be imposed upon people by these unelected judges. The situation, however, is not entirely grim. They don't dominate things entirely, and there are two hopeful signs. One of them is that Harvard has traditionally had an affirmative action program for students to ensure that they get representation from all minority groups. However, Harvard steadfastly has refused to impose this on the faculty, which every year leads to a huge hullabaloo, but which suggests that deep down in their hearts they know they're wrong. But I think the best sign of all was a little incident that occurred. We were discussing in class one day, in criminal law class, the felony murder rule, which says that if you rob a bank and somebody is killed, even if it's not by you, the crime is nonetheless charged to you. And various ingenious explanations came forward as to why this rule, which has a very powerful deterrent effect, was a bad thing. And finally, from the very back row, a very long drawl came forward from a student from Kentucky who said, "I won't even try to imitate the accent. I don't know about the rest of you, but in my part of the country, we're a little tired of the ingenuity with which Harvard law students use to explain why criminals should not be punished, and would like to see some of their ingenuity applied." This took about 15 minutes to say. Some of their ingenuity applied to the actual catching and punishing of criminals. And there's sort of a pause, and then about half the class burst out into applause. That's the single most hopeful thing that I've seen yet there. I hope to see many more hopeful things. But there are some hopeful things from Canada. The people, you who are unfortunate enough to read the Washington Post will notice yesterday that the editorial in the Washington Post pointed out that, as we all know, there are two kinds of conservatives, not economic and social conservatives, but good conservatives and bad conservatives. An example of a bad conservative would be Ronald Reagan. An example of a good conservative would be Brian Mulroney. At this point, a Canadian conservative should begin reaching for his wallet. It's been a good week for Canada. In fact, this week, the New York Times carried a story about how Pierre Trudeau had come down to Washington to receive a peace prize, in which he denounced NATO's macho posturing. So it's been a big week in the news for us. But there are good things going on there, which I think are important. Just a general rough sketch of the economic situation there. The Canadian government spends about $103 billion a year and collects about $70 billion in taxes, which makes a $30 billion deficit, as you don't figure out, which is about double per capita what you've got. And this is aggravated by the fact that we spend only 1.8% of our GNP on defense. So all of this money is being used to fulfill human needs, which means that a lot of it gets wasted. Now, Brian Mulroney, in his first weeks in office, has been saying a lot of very good things. And if, in fact, he does them, we're all going to be very happy. He has said he's going to decontrol the price of Canadian petroleum, allow it to rise to the world price. He has made some noises that the budget may be cut, and even that the universality, the principle that everybody, regardless of financial need, should receive the same amount of welfare, mother's allowance, and all these things should be available to rich and poor alike. That principle may be questioned. He's even suggested that there may be some hope that Canada will get a flat tax if the United States does. And in fact, one positive accomplishment, I should say he hasn't suggested it, people around him have, and this is an idea that is a persistent rumor and a hopeful one. He has even gone to the step, to some substantive steps. One is that the Conservative government may very well, in fact, I think is already committed to selling four crown corporations, nationalized businesses. And the other is that the Conservative government is committed to negotiating sectoral free trade with the United States in a series of important areas. Now, admittedly, that had been negotiated by the previous government. But nonetheless, it's important. And of course, the final and most important good thing about Brian Mulroney is that he is not Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who by the end of his time in office had managed to offend everybody, even the press. In fact, at his last press conference before he left office, reporters clustered around him as he hopped into his Mercedes-Benz sports car. They said to him, "Any regrets, Mr. Prime Minister?" And he thought for a moment. He said, "Yes, I only regret I won't have you to kick around anymore." But all these hopeful signs should be taken within the context of a country in which the conservative movement is a very, very shallow plant indeed, and one which I think does not necessarily face a prosperous future. Recently, in the first economic statement preparatory to their main budget, the conservative government cut about $2.2 billion out of this $103 billion budget. How real that cut is questionable, but there it is on paper. Of that $2 billion, $200 million was cut out of the unemployment program, an $11 billion program. That's, about a 3% cut out of that one program and a 0.1% cut out of the total budget. Headline in the most important newspaper in the country was, "Mulroney slashes government spending." And with that idea toward government spending, it's going to be very, very difficult indeed to turn this government around. It should be pointed out that those crown corporations that are being sold are probably going to be bought by provincial governments. It also should be pointed out that this government really has absolutely no economic plans whatsoever. The main thing is to sit tight, pray to God that Reagan's policies work, and then, of course, bask in the credit if they do. And if they don't, I guess they're just going to have to run for the hills, because they really don't have anything else in mind. Finally, one major catastrophe looming on the horizon, and there's some doubt as to whether it will materialize or not, is the last government commissioned a royal commission to investigate the question of whether or not Canada, the federal government, should impose affirmative action and comparable worth on the private sector. The report of this thing is due any day, and it's on Tuesday, thank you. And it's almost certain to say both of them are just the greatest ideas you can possibly imagine. Now, the question is, will Brian Mulroney have the backbone to stand up to this? Personally, I doubt it, although I am told by many people who are much closer to him than I am that I'm wrong and do him a great injustice. Time will tell. Finally, one other point ought to be made, which is that Mulroney, even though it's a parliamentary government, and even though he has much more control over his government than, say, an American president does over his, has only got 6 months to a year before the provinces, the bureaucracy, and the press close in on him. He does not intend to bring down a major budget statement until April. He's going to blow his 6 months doing useful things like making sure the right kind of people get patronage appointments, to be sure, but without much substantive legislative accomplishment. If the American recovery doesn't pull through for him and give him an ideological mandate to go farther, he's in big trouble. And so, I might add, are all Canadians. Two last comments before I shut up and sit down. Mulroney himself, it should be realized, is not an ideological man. He's pro-business, he's a nice man, he's a conciliator, but he does not feel that burning passion in his stomach for free enterprise that Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher so obviously do. But here, and I promise to give you some hopeful signs, here is the hopeful sign. The Conservative Party in Ontario, the biggest and richest province, the party that has governed that province since 1943, is in the moment in the midst of a leadership campaign. One of the candidates in that campaign has commissioned a poll of members of the party. 95% of the members of the Ontario Conservative Party think of themselves as to the right of their party. Now that, I think, is a very, very serious bit of good news indeed. It's, of course, bad news because of the way it reflects on that party, but it's also good news in the sense that it shows that in the most populous province, the most successful political organization in the entire country has got some very serious pulls to the right. And that's good news. I think then, if you're going to look for a prognosis on Canada, is that Canada is going to go on electing conservative politicians so long as international economic circumstances force it to, but nothing on earth has to make them like it, and they're not going to. And with that, I think I will bid you adieu and sit down. Mm-hmm.